From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm producer Megan Mack, alongside host Evan Dawson.
What a week, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it's been quite a week.
It has been quite a week. I'm kind of debating on how much we want to peel back the curtain and tell people about what the week has been. Because on the air, I like to believe that no one is the wiser that the turmoil that we've gone through. What do you think?
Well, I like to say that a lot of my job is adapting and adjusting, and yours is too.
Yes.
And we did a lot of that this week.
That's a good way to put it. Yes, this is just one of those weeks, and not to dwell on it for listeners, because we'll get to the point in a second here, but this is just one of those weeks that it felt like a lot of things either fell through at the last second or promises were not kept or those kind of things. But it happens, and we scrambled, and if there were not two people working on this program, if I were on vacation or if you weren't here, this would have been a totally different week.
There would have been tears.
Lots of tears. I cried anyway. I cry every week. But anyway, we made it through, and I want to open with a remarkable story. And as I said on the show, I'm kind of amazed that this story is not being taught in schools today, because we all know Brown v. Board of Education, but we don't know the case that essentially laid the groundwork for Brown. So here's a little background. 1944, Orange County, California. Sylvia Mendez was a third grade student, and her school told her that her skin was too dark to attend the mainly white school. Sylvia's family is of Mexican and Puerto Rican descent.
So Sylvia's family sued to desegregate. The superintendent made some starkly racist comments during the court proceedings. He said that Mexican students shouldn't be allowed in his white school because they have lice. But Sylvia's family won, and it became a precedent that helped future desegregation activists.
So we talked to Sylvia on Monday, the day she turned 80 years old. Now, this weekend, the Rochester Latino Theater Company is debuting a play about Sylvia's story called Separate is Never Equal. Here's Sylvia sharing her memory of being a third grade student who couldn't go to the white school.
All I knew was that I couldn't go to that beautiful school with that wonderful playground. That was what was in my mind. It wasn't until I went to a white school and this little boy comes up and starts telling me that I don't belong there. You know, even though I was in court every single day, I never realized what my parents were fighting for. I thought they were just fighting for me to get into that beautiful school with a wonderful playground. It wasn't until we finally integrated and I went to the white school, and this little boy comes and tells me I don't belong there because I'm a Mexican. And I start crying, and I go in and tell my mother, "Mother, I don't want to go to that school. They don't want us there." That my mother tells me, she starts talking to me. She says, "Sylvia, don't you realize what we were fighting for? Don't you know that you are just as good as that little boy, and under God, we're all equal? And of course you're going to go back to school." And from then on, I continued to realize what they had fought for.
Sylvia, now looking back, do you look at what the school superintendent said, the terrible things that were on signs, all of those things, does that feel like a different world to you, or do you feel like that America isn't still not that far away from that time?
Well, I feel that, you know, what Brown and Mendez fought for was for de jure. By law, we cannot be segregated. And I feel that we are more segregated now than we were in 1944. It seems like we've gone a full circle around. You know, we're celebrating this year the 70-year anniversary of Mendez versus Westminster. And as I go around speaking at schools to the students, I find out that we are completely segregated in some schools where the two schools named after my parents, they're 100% Latino. So we're 100% segregated in some of the schools. So we have a lot of work to do yet.
Let's keep the focus on the California courts. Seems like everyone is talking about the Stanford rape case this week.
That's the story of Brock Turner, a 20-year-old student who sexually assaulted a woman who had passed out at a party. Turner was found guilty of 3 felony sexual assault charges, but the judge in the case decided that Turner should only get 6 months in jail. Not the 6 years the prosecutors wanted, because a long sentence could hurt Turner's future.
That sentence sparked a national conversation about privilege and whether poor or minority defendants would get the same consideration. We talked to Daniel Ponder, a local criminal defense attorney.
Obviously, white privilege and wealth, you know, class privilege, I think are the things that stand out. I was just thinking, I had a client who was offered 10 months for driving without a license. So I see much worse sentences for people of color for lesser crimes. And this is not a matter of opinion. This is a fact that we know that people of color are sentenced harsher for the same crimes as their white counterparts. So the criminal justice system being a racist system is not an opinion. It's an actual fact. But also as a defense attorney, and this is going to be controversial to say, but I do believe in mitigation, mitigating factors. I do believe in compassion. I do think that our community in our country has an over-reliance on incarcerating people as a way to deal with issues. So in this, when, you know, when I read the story, my reaction is not, yeah, he should be under the jail. My reaction was more so, I wish that clients of color, defendants of color, were given the same opportunity to have mitigating factors heard. I believe in restorative justice, so I believe that healing has to occur for both parties. So I'm not someone who will sit here and just say, this guy's the scum of the earth and he should be under the jail.
Lock him up forever. Okay, right. And fair enough. And again, that's why there's so many different threads here. But on restorative justice, don't you at least have to first acknowledge that what you did was violent and horrible? I mean, that letter from his father, and again, that's a father who loves his child, but he said that wasn't even an act of violence.
I think the father's letter was terrible.
Okay.
I think it was awful. If that was my client, I would be like, you're not submitting this letter. Because I do think that at this point he has been found guilty. And you're right, with restorative justice, one of the biggest pieces is acknowledgement of what was done wrong in the case. And I think focusing on him not being able to eat a steak or, you know, 20 minutes of a nonviolent act are just completely ridiculous. But the fact that the father's letter was even heard, was even publicized, is largely due to the fact that this is a rich white kid, right? So the narrative gets larger when it's white children or when it's children who are wealthy.
Our next story was, well, it's also a California story. I guess it's California week on the show, but this is a story that goes way beyond California and impacts all of us.
Donald Trump recently said that he thinks there is no drought in California. Scientists responded that not only is there a drought, it's the worst drought in decades, and it's made worse by climate change. For our monthly science roundtable, we welcomed three scientists, Josh Goldowitz and Matthew Hoffman of RIT, and John Stella of SUNY ESF. Here's Evan asking whether we're putting agriculture and human populations in the wrong places. You'll notice that part of the answer given by the panel looks at how all of this comes back to Western New York.
It's going to be very difficult to control population growth, except that, you know, currently the expense of living in certain parts of California is certainly controlling the amount of people coming in. But I don't think that water is going to be limiting cities and the growth of cities. But in agriculture, I think it will play more and more of a role. The sort of best thinkers about how to fix California's water problem, there's a number of folks throughout the state, including Dr. Jay Lund at UC Davis and Peter Moyle at UC Davis. They advocate a portfolio of different solutions, but they have to be done in concert. And there's no magic, there's no silver bullet, there's no magic solution to California's water problems. But it's going to involve It's going to have to involve loosening some regulations in terms of water transfers. It will also have to be improving technologies such as desalinization, and water pricing will also be really important. Water conservation will continue to be important, but the cities in California are some of the most water efficient in the country, and there's just not going to be a lot more that they can do in terms of solving the massive overages that the state is demanding currently.
Josh Goldowitz?
I guess I disagree with that a little bit. I think water's the new oil. This is what wars are going to be fought over in the future. The U.S. State Department has identified 10 places on Earth where they think it's possible that there will be actual warfare over water rights. A desert, you know, the definition for a desert is an area that gets so little rainfall that it can't support a significant human population. And yet Phoenix is probably the fastest growing city in the country, and LA isn't far behind. So I think, you know, water pricing, real pricing, might induce people not to move to those areas. I mean, we in Rochester are blessed with a vast amount of water. You know, maybe people will start moving back to what's called the Rust Belt because we will have the resource that is needed for industry, agriculture, and for people to live.
Yeah. Okay, Matthew?
It was funny because I was about 8 years ago, I was in Brazil, and I remember getting yelled at by somebody down there because they were talking about the Iraq war and how they were sort of just getting mad at me in the future for the anticipating a war on Brazil for the Amazon River water. That was sort of getting prematurely yelled at for that. In addition to add on to what Josh said, in addition to already the amount of water that we have here, right, climate projections for this region of the country are actually wetter and warmer. And so some of the future into this century projections are that we might actually have an extra month of growing season in the Rochester region.
I will say again, if you saw the film The Big Short, the end credits had an interesting point about water. One of the characters in the film, played by Christian Bale, was a real-life financial analyst who is now focusing, essentially betting all of his energy on water as a commodity.
And speaking of placing bets, the city of Rochester is considering a new proposal to build a casino downtown.
This proposal comes from the Seneca Nation of Indians. Now, the city says there's no done deal here. The mayor says she's listening. But on the show, city spokesman Jim Smith certainly made it sound like the city wants a casino. Listen to how he justifies the possibility of a casino. Here he is responding to my point that if you look historically at American casinos, they tend to fall way short of the promise of sparking economic development and jobs in the surrounding areas.
You're right, but remember now, that is a different model. That's not the same casino that we're talking about. Okay, so we're talking about what's an urban casino model. That model does not have a hotel. It does not have a signature restaurant. It is not a casino that tries to keep people inside and be all things to them. It instead tries to work with the vibrancy of a downtown that has a lot of amenities and a lot of things going for it. That model is seen in Buffalo, in downtown Buffalo, and we have sought evidence-based information, if you will, on that. The mayor has had conversations with Byron Brown, the mayor of Buffalo, and what was promised by that development, the mayor of Buffalo has said the Seneca Nation Indians have delivered on, that they've lived up to that promise and that Buffalo is doing very well as a result of that. And the area immediately surrounding the casino has begun to see an enormous amount of development, and it has been very positive. There's similar casino models in Cleveland and also Pittsburgh. So this isn't the Atlantic City model or the Seneca Niagara model. This is a different urban casino model that actually looks to become part of a vibrant urban area and not to be, from our perspective, not to look at this as something that would be a destination unto itself, but that would be one of many destinations that could potentially draw visitors and that could also hold a lot of potential to help us develop the area around it. And remember that this jobs issue is very important because we really are trying to focus on ways to work to lift people out of poverty. And so one of the things I want to stress is that the city is not focused on a casino or, for that matter, a performing arts center. I know I've said it before, but I can't say this enough. We are looking at every option that will help us tick those two boxes. The first box, provide jobs for people that most need them. And the second box, which is to make sure that we can find some development that will be an anchor, a development that will be a catalyst to help improve the atmosphere downtown and to bring people into our center city and the core of our city so that we don't just have people here from 9 to 5 working and then Main Street becomes a ghost town. You know, recently I'll share with you two things, and they're sort of the canary in the mine, if you will. There was an initiative where folks came from Ruth Chris Steakhouse and they were going to look to maybe locate one of their facilities here in Rochester. And they came back and they said that downtown Rochester wasn't suitable for that because there's just not enough activity there. There's just not enough going on, and that they wanted to pass us by. And that's, you know, unfortunate, but I think it tells us we know what we need to do, and that is we need to find critical mass downtown. We need to find a way to get people into the center city and to keep them there.
We should point out that local ministers are opposing a casino, and they told us the opposition will only get stronger.
And they were not at all convinced by the city's explanation for why a casino can work in Rochester. I want to close this week on what was the most emotional moment of connection during the last 5 days. We had Don Elhardt in studio, Don celebrating 50 years in broadcasting, most of those years as the main anchor for Channel 13 in Rochester. I asked Don about his very close friend, the late Bill Peterson. Bill was a meteorologist on the air, but more than anything, he was a popular personality. And in thinking about his friend, Don Elhardt revealed a story I had never heard before. We'll start with my question about Bill that sparked this particular memory. Bill passed away shortly after I got here, but of course he was this legend that everybody had known about. And you see all these great moments. And Bill would not be accused by modern consultants of having a TV wardrobe. You know, he had great ties and, you know, he had his own style. And he was willing to roll with it and willing to laugh and go off the rails. And people appreciated that. My concern, and this is where I hope you're going to tell me I'm wrong. My concern is that if a Bill Peterson walked in for an interview today, because of the modern consultants and you have to look this way, you have to talk this way, you have to sound this way, that he might not get a job. And I hope that's wrong.
It might be, you know, it could be a challenge. By the way, I just looked at that carried on my phone. Bill Peterson died August 5th, 2006.
2006, yeah.
So it goes back, it goes back quite a way. I'll get back to your point, because that reminds me of the day he died. He was on a ventilator at Strong, and I had visited him during the week, and he said to the family, "I want Don here when we pull the plug." And I said, "I don't know if I can handle that." And it was a Saturday morning. He said, "I picked the time, Saturday morning at noon." He said he chose the time when, because that was it. I said I would be there. 10 o'clock in the morning, I get a phone call. It's his son. And he said, "My dad says that most of the time you are always 15 to 20 minutes late for whatever you do." He said, "And my dad says, don't be late today."
Wow.
I mean, you talk about a bit of humor and a huge dose of emotion.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
I drove to the hospital. I stood there, watched him touch the stomach of his daughter-in-law, the first grandchild that he would never see. There have been many since that he's never seen. And said my goodbyes and then watched him die. The family handed me a book and said, "Would you please read this poem?" And I can't tell you now what it was. I have never been challenged to read something out loud like that in my life. Somehow I got through it, and somehow we got through the days that followed. But it was, certainly a challenging moment. It would be difficult now. We've gone. You know, I put a picture up on Facebook the other day of the three TV weathermen in town: Chuck Stevens, Bob Bills, and me. I don't think any of us had any experience in meteorology. I think John Hamilton was probably the first one at Channel 10 years ago that was a meteorologist. And all of a sudden, that became the gold standard. You had to be a meteorologist. And Bill was. He was a meteorologist in the Air Force, so he certainly had the credibility. I would hope that the personality is still going to play a role, because it's I think we see it. And everybody has a different personality. Glenn's is different than Bill's was. But you have to, I think, bring out the naturalness in people. And if there's a goodness and a natural flair that's there, I think it's going to prevail. I often tell people, if you go to a new city you've never been to before, you pick out a newscast to watch, you don't know who's number one. You don't know who's got the most journalistic awards. You don't know any of that. You look at the people and you watch the ones you like to look at. You look at the people that look like they might be somebody you'd want to know. And if you can accomplish that, I think you're going to come out ahead.
Don's a wonderful storyteller, and 13 Wham News will air a one-hour special on Don's 50 years in broadcasting. That special is next Friday night at 8 p.m.
That wraps up this edition of Weekend Connections. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and Finger Lakes Public Radio, WEOS 89.5 FM.
And you can find us at all times on your mobile device with the WXXI mobile app. By the way, Meg, if I had plans with you this weekend, I would cancel them at the last minute just to keep the theme. I would do that.
But that's consistent.
I hope you have a wonderful weekend. Totally peaceful and uninterrupted.
Thank you. You too.
I will say the same to all of our listeners, and we will talk with you on Monday.